Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. I'm here in Cornwall at the moment in a rather echoey room, but I hope it's going across okay.
Sounds all right to me. Thanks for taking time out of your holiday to feed our loyal audience a new episode. We're starting a kind of short series today, aren't we, where we're kind of stepping away from our kind of bread and butter of looking at new developments in science, technology, or kind of news stories or questions, and stepping back and looking at some of the fundamental foundations or doctrines, you might say, of a kind of Christian perspective on the world. Maybe that some of the Christian thinking that has shaped how you and, to a lesser extent, me kind of talk about ethics and science and healthcare, you know, the kind of basic doctrines that are the foundation stones that we build our superstructure on.
Yeah, I mean, it can sound a bit dry and theological, but I hope as we unpick it, I can persuade our listeners that actually this is something to be amazingly excited about, these rich truths. And basically what we're going to be looking at in four separate episodes are four foundations, which are creation, fall, redemption, and then new creation. Or actually, it's often described consummation, which is an interesting term, but it's one that actually has a lot of truth about it, because the whole point about the future plan of the Bible story is that it is a consummation. It's a drawing together, an ultimate fulfillment of everything that was there. I've subsequently sort of moved away from using this phrase consummation just because it's got these sort of sexual overtones, which is a pity, really, because I think it is a very helpful word. But this idea that there is a future hope, that there is a new creation, I think that's a really important part. So each of these four foundations are important.
And we're starting today with the beginning, the right place to start, I guess, which is the doctrine of creation, which, you know, is right there at the start of the Bible, and is, people will be very familiar with, you know, the Genesis accounts in Genesis 1, 2, 3. But your kind of contention, I suppose, is that actually we don't spend quite enough time as we think we are in kind of dwelling in this doctrine and letting it come to fruition and undergird our understanding.
Yeah, I think what I've come to realize is that each of these four foundations are, in a sense, equally important. And they provide four different but internally coherent ways of looking at the world. So, and it's a very, very useful heuristic or a teaching aid, a framework, which I've used time and time again. So that whenever we come across some often quite novel or unexpected issue, I mean, you know, like artificial intelligence, for instance, or gender fluidity, or some kind of unexpected development in our modern world, I've found that this fourfold framework, we start with creation, we look at how God has made the world and created this particular thing, we then look at fall, how did it go wrong and contaminated. We then look at redemption, the great story of the incarnation, the cross and the resurrection, and finally this future consummation. And I use that when I first came across it, when John Stott was using it in his preaching and in his book Issues Facing Christians Today. And ever since, it's been a sort of foundation framework for me in my thinking.
It's fascinating as well, because by coincidence, or you know, not really coincidence, it's a very similar framework. Actually, was a key part of the preaching and the approach of a pastor, a minister at a church I used to attend in central London called KXE, and the vicar there, Pete Hughes, his version of this was creation, decreation, recreation, which was this kind of heuristic, is the posh word. It's a kind of framework, as you say, a teaching aid, a lens through which we then can examine different parts of scripture and Christian tradition and help us kind of fit various sermon series and bits of the Bible together. So it's clearly an idea, I think, which is spread. I don't think John Stott invented it, as you say. It can probably be traced back to some of the earlier church fathers, people like Augustine in particular. But yeah, I think it's a helpful way of us stepping back from the day-to-day maelstrom of issues like something like AI, you mentioned, gender fluidity, or you know, reproductive technology at the beginning of life, and helping us make sure that we're not accidentally, I guess, slipping into a kind of sub-Christian understanding of these things.
Yes, so I was brought up in the Christian Brethren, which was a much bigger denomination back in the 60s and 70s than it is now. They in particular had a very negative and suspicious view of creation. It seemed like everything outside the true Christian church was broken. It was wrecked by evil and by sin. And that was regarded as the world, and it was hostile to Christianity. It was the terrain of the evil one, and it was a dangerous source of temptation. It would drag you in. And so everything that wasn't focused on Christian activity was regarded as worldly, and it was secondary importance and a dangerous thing. And so the most important thing was to try to keep yourself free from being contaminated by the world and to focus on Christian worship and on whatever the local church was doing. It probably sounds pretty weird to you now, but you know, this was completely normal for me growing up as a child.
Yeah, I mean, it is slightly kooky, particularly I think having kind of heard of other bits and pieces about the Brethren as they are today, and They have a reputation, I think, for being quite kind of secluded and closed off and insular and hostile to the outside world. And, you know, some people would say almost at points kind of verging on a sect in terms of their kind of desire to cut themselves off. And I guess the sense that they and they alone are the kind of true believers, the true Christians, and their sense of hostility to the outside world extends to lots of other, you know, big mainstream established denominations as well. But at the same time, I can definitely see notes, elements of that theology present in the more kind of mainstream conservative evangelicalism that I grew up in, which again is there's that dualism idea of there's us and then there's the world, or there's kind of God's kingdom and the world. And the world is not just, you know, people actively doing sinful things, but it potentially includes a whole bunch of stuff which might be kind of morally neutral, but is, as you say, is a distraction from the real task of the believer in the church, which is, you know, prayer and Bible study and evangelism and things like that. And that I think that at times can kind of curdle into a suspicion and hostility about the stuff that God has created.
Yeah, and our particular brand of the Brethren took this to quite extreme levels in terms of using music in worship. They regarded music, art, any kind of introducing a note of beauty particularly man-made beauty into Christian worship was dangerous and worldly, and therefore we in the weekly meetings, the Holy Communion meeting, the breaking of bread, we didn't have any musical instruments, not even a piano or a guitar. It was then just an unaccompanied singing. A cappella was the only way to worship God. So, you know, as somebody who was very, very interested in music and an amateur musician, I always found this strange. And it was one of the big things that, to be honest, which drew me to All Souls Church as a student. And that was that they were starting an orchestra to be used for worship. The idea a full symphony orchestra could actually play in church services and used for worship. But it was not just the music. Behind this was actually a deep theology, a biblical theology about using music for worship. And of course, that's very much related to the idea of creation theology.
Well, could you just flesh that out a little bit for us? Some people might be a bit puzzled. What is the relationship between music and the theology of creation?
Well, so the idea is that God has put music into the creation. It's something, it's actually his idea. There are all kinds of, you know, the physics of music is quite interesting, the way that strings vibrate and the vocal cords vibrate, the way we appreciate harmony, the mathematical relationships between notes, all these things are actually part of the creation. And throughout the scriptures, but particularly in the Psalms, you see how all this created gift of musicianship is to be used to worship God. And it seems to me that actually fundamentally this is what music is for. The reason that God has created music is as an expression to allow us to express the deepest emotions of our heart back in worship to God. And as a musician playing for worship, you know, leading a congregation, using gifts of music and orchestration and harmony to encourage people to sing and to worship from their hearts, I find something incredibly moving and a sense of, yes, this is what it's for. This is the rightness of music. Of course, you can use music for all sorts of other things. You can use music to sell soap powder. You can use music to arouse an army to war. Music can be used in lots of different ways, but it seems to me when it is used primarily for worship, there's a rightness about it. This is what it was created for.
And what I find really interesting and quite fun about this perspective is there's a sense in which that actually God wants us to enjoy the good things he's put in creation. And when we talk about that, we often think about, like, oh, look, the sun sets and, you know, that beautiful mountain. And we can look at this and say, wow, what an amazing God made that. And absolutely, that's fantastic. And I do that and it's great. But I like the idea that actually there's more to creation than just the physical stuff, the atoms, you know, that you know, God also, there's no reason why, you know, those two particular notes when played together should make a beautiful, pleasing sound as a chord, as a harmony. But God built it into the fabric of the atoms of the universe and gave us the capacity to enjoy that. And even beyond simply, you know, yes, we can use that in worship, in church, in our private devotionals, but also there's a sense in which actually the rightness of simply making music, even if it's not explicitly Christian music, is also enjoying the beauty in God's creation and saying, this world that God has made is full of beautiful things and it is right and good and proper for us to enjoy taking part in that.
Absolutely right. And that for me was this complete liberation. The idea that there wasn't something worldly about enjoying music or becoming better at music or investigating and learning it. And I think actually that happened for many professional musicians, that for the first time playing at All Souls as part of a semi-professional, professional quality orchestra allowed them to suddenly discover new meaning in their own expertise, you know, that and calling and ministry. So, and it, it was not just music. So I think there was also a rediscovery of Christians in all kinds of creative and artistic professions, in the fine arts, in media, in writing, and so on. I think that rediscovery of creation theology, and even in sport. I mean, when we were talking earlier, you mentioned this Eric Liddell. Do you want to say a bit about that?
Yeah, yeah. People might be familiar with Eric Liddell from the film Chariots of Fire. He was a really fascinating, intriguing person from the first half of the 20th century. He's a Christian guy, Scottish guy, I believe, who ran for Great Britain in the Olympics in the 1920s, and had this kind of fascinating rivalry with some of the other sprinters at the time. He was a sprinter, and he was just one of the best in the world. I think he might have even won a medal, but he kind of became famous because he refused to run on Sundays, which he believed should be kind of set apart as a day of rest. And he wanted to go to church and not take part. And then there was a controversy because one of the Olympic finals was on a Sunday. Would they move it for him and blah, 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 blah. And that's what the film is about. And then he went on and had a rich life as a missionary in China. But there's an amazing line from the film Chariots of Fire. I don't know if it's a true thing he ever said, but it rings true. And it's always stuck with me, which is where he's trying to explain to someone about, you know, how does he hold in tension his Christian faith and his running. And he says, you know, I believe that God made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. And that line has always stuck with me because there's, in the kind of, you know, conventional view of the world that we were talking about, where, you know, it's about being useful and staying out of distractions and worldly things, there's nothing more worldly than just sprinting, right? Just running in a straight line as fast as you can achieves absolutely nothing. And yet, Liddell explains that actually he believes that in God's creative beauty, when he knitted together Eric Liddell in the womb, he gave him the exact right kind of muscle fibers and genetic coding and everything that made him one of the fastest men in the world. And actually God's calling on his life wasn't simply just to go and be a missionary, but it was actually to use this body, these fast legs that God had given him, and just enjoy that in it, kind of for no real purpose, just because he enjoys it because God made him fast. So yeah, that's always really stuck with me. And again, it had a kind of liberating effect when you realize that we don't have to be constantly crippled by this sense of, am I doing things that are useful, that are productive, that are quote unquote Christian in inverted commas, but actually we can do things that are enjoying the beauty of God's creation for its own sake, and that's enough.
Yeah, it's interesting because that phrase had a big impact on me too. God made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. Because I believe there's a sense in which every single human being can say that. Every single human being can say, in some way, God made me fast. And therefore, I need to learn what that is, because when I do that, I feel his pleasure. There's a positive joy in just being who I was meant to be, in running the race, whatever the race is that it's been given to me. So just to then step back and dig a bit deeper into creation theology, the beautiful idea is that the creation is not some kind of just arbitrary, cold, logical structure, which is the way science and physics tends to regard these days. You know, physicalism regards ultimate matter as basically the most foundational level is just subatomic particles and the equations or the fields which hold everything together. And therefore, at their root, in that way of thinking, matter is fundamentally impersonal. Whereas the beautiful thing of biblical theology is the idea that actually before creation, there are persons in love, and the Father loves the Son, and the Son loves the Father, and the Father loves the Spirit, and the Spirit loves the Father. And this love has been circulating and intensifying within the very heart of the Godhead. And as the love builds up and it builds up and it builds up, then there is an explosion of love. And I think in some ways that's what the Big Bang is. The Big Bang is an explosion of love from the heart of the Trinity. And therefore everything that we see from galaxies and the macro structure of the universe down to the most tiny subatomic particles and the mysteries of life and everything is an explosion of love. It therefore reflects the love and the character of God himself.
And this is why the author of Genesis has this refrain about God saw what he had made and it was good. It's about saying, because, you know, I remember being really struck when someone was explaining that you have to read, you know, often we read Genesis and we get lost in these very interesting and important debates about creationism versus evolution. We know we've done podcasts about this, but we also have to read, understand that the Genesis account is written in a time when there are lots of competing stories in the ancient Near East world about how stuff came into being, you know, and some of those cultures that surrounded the ancient Israelites had beliefs that, you know, the gods had had a fight and they'd kill one of the gods and then creation was made out of the decaying kind of remains of one of the dead gods, or that the gods had had sex and had a baby and that was creation, or that, you know, the gods had cut off part of their own body and turned it into human beings. And there's always a sense that creation can be born out of conflict, out of rivalry, out of anger, out of death, out of violence. And so what is really profound about the Genesis account is that creation, as you say, is this loving, voluntary act. That there was nothingness. And God in eternity past existed totally content in the Trinity with nothing else there. But then, because they loved so much, they decided to say, let there be light, let there be stuff, and ultimately let there be people for us to love on. And that's why the author keeps coming back to saying, God saw this and God said it was good, it was good, it was good, it was good.
Absolutely. And then, so creation reflects these four, that often, these three, that are often called transcendentals, the truth, goodness, and beauty. It's interesting that that trio was really identified by Greek philosophers as being the transcendentals. But as Christian theology developed, it realized that those three encapsulated the character and the being of God. So creation is based on truth. There is a fundamental unchanging order. And where does that come from? And why is it upheld? Because it isn't just God winds up the creation and leaves it. No, every moment the creation, the truth, the continuity, the order of the creation is sustained by God. And really that's a reflection of his covenant faithfulness, that God chooses, God has a covenant, a creation covenant. And he says, I am going to be faithful to this covenant. I'm going to up to this creation. I'm going to uphold it. I'm going to maintain the law of gravity. I'm going to maintain the structure and the order out of love, out of my covenant faithfulness, because that's the kind of God I am. And similarly, not only is God maintaining the physical structures, the mathematics, the physics that underlies it all, God is actually holding the moral order. God is defining what is good and has put his goodness, the moral order, his character actually into the creation. So I like to think of it like the grain of wood, you know, that we're called to live our life along this grain, the moral order that is there in the universe.
And one of the things that's quite striking when I've read things, people, you know, kind of scientists and physicists talking about the order in the universe is not the surprising thing is not that the surprising thing is that we keep finding that there is universal order, and that as we dig down through various levels of subatomic particles, that, you know, you can create this model of the world based on four fundamental forces that are constants everywhere at all times in all places of the universe. You know, the speed of light and the weak magnetic force, you know, and I'm not a physicist and I'm on shaky ground here, you know more of this than I do. But actually, there is no fundamental reason why the universe has to work like that. It could be a chaos. It could be disordered. And yet the more we understand and the more knowledge we accumulate, we actually find that, as you say, the whole, everything down to the individual bonds that hold electrons together is ordered and systematic and knowable, fundamentally understandable by us, made in the image of the Creator.
Absolutely. And of course, this is a Christian understanding of why science is possible, why it works. And again, from a physicalist point of view, there's absolutely no reason why an evolved species on the African savanna, whose central nervous system developed in order to be better at finding berries and avoiding predators, why that particular central nervous system should be able to work out and comprehend the fundamental structures of the cosmos. I mean, that is a complete mystery. For a physicalist scientist, it's just an amazing lucky fluke, like everything else, just a lucky fluke. Christianity gives a much more intellectually coherent and profound explanation. God made the universe to be comprehensible, and he made human beings to be able to comprehend them because we are made in his image. Our puny minds can reflect the mind of the Creator.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from NT Wright. Ask NT Wright Anything, The Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now let's get back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So that's truth and order. What about goodness?
Yeah, so goodness, you know, it's only recently I've realized the profound significance of the passage in Exodus 33 and 34, where God, Yahweh, the God of the covenant, the God of the Jewish people, reveals himself to Moses. And he says to Moses, I will make all my goodness pass before you. And then he proclaims the name of Yahweh. And the name, of course, in Hebrew thinking, encapsulates the being, the character, the essence. And he says, God, full of compassion and grace, long-suffering and rich in steadfast love, and faithfulness. There are five things there, it seems to me, in that passage, God himself declares what his goodness consists of. And they're remarkable. They're all relational terms: compassion, grace, steadfast love, faithfulness, long suffering. And I think the idea is that God's goodness is enshrined in creation. Everywhere we turn in creation, we see goodness. We see God's goodness. And there's an old Hebrew proverb, which I love, which says that he who gave us teeth will provide us with bread. In other words, God creates needs, desires. He creates mechanisms precisely so he can satisfy them, precisely so that he can give us joy. And that's part of his goodness.
Hmm. And there's something really heartwarming about this idea that, you know, God can't help himself. He is so good. It is so rooted in his character that everything he touches, everything he makes, you know, smacks of that goodness. It is shot through like a stick of Brighton rock with that goodness. You know, and you see that in passages, you know, where it talks about, you know, God cannot tell a lie. You know, God, it's that God is so faithful to his character that everything he touches kind of turns to gold.
Yeah, it's a very, very rich and profound, and as you say, heartwarming. It's the way he is. And actually, I've come to realize in many ways, this is what we mean by the beauty of God, to be drawn to the beauty of God. You know, I used to think that was something like a sunset. You know, it was like it was seeing glory in terms of transcendence or something like fireworks going off. That's the beauty of God. But increasingly, I see actually it's much more to do with the beauty of his character. It's the way you're drawn to someone else just because they're such a wonderful person. That's the beauty of God. We find we are just drawn to his goodness because it's beautiful.
And that's, you know, we would argue, I guess, why even people who have no belief in God or no knowledge of God cannot help but be compelled by the beauty of a sunset, or, you know, the goodness of the love of a mother for her child, or whatever else that God has made. You know, even if you aren't aware of the creator, the goodness of what he has created shines through unmistakably.
Absolutely right. And of course, this is also this idea of common grace, that God's goodness and grace is not just limited to his people, but he just loves to give it to everyone. Because that's the kind of God he is, a giving God, the graciousness of it. He doesn't say, well, you know, do you deserve food today? Do you deserve my sun to shine on you? He just gives it away. It's free. And
the rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous alike.
Exactly. And then finally, there's beauty, isn't there, that this astonishing thing that everywhere we see, everywhere we look, we see beauty. You know, I often think that, you know, the writers of the Bible had no concept of the beauty of the cosmos, which the James Webb telescope is now revealing. They had no concept of the beauty of the microscope shows about the wonders. They had no concept of what it was like underneath the ocean to see life in all its glory and so on, everywhere, or the way that a baby was being formed, you know, with a four-dimensional ultrasound scan. And yet they still poured out their hearts. So how much more do we moderns have awareness of the extraordinary beauty? Everywhere we go, we find the beauty of God. I sometimes think that, you know, in those medieval cathedrals, you'd get a stonemason on the top of a very long ladder or scaffolding, you know, hundreds of feet above the ground, and he'd spend months hacking out with his chisel this most beautiful rose out of stone and making it absolutely perfect and beautiful. And then he would get down his ladder and go down to the bottom, and nobody would ever see it. Why did he make it beautiful? It was for the joy of creation. The fact that nobody was going to see it didn't matter. And I just think that reflects the character of God. You know, everywhere we turn, God has made it beautiful, even if nobody ever saw it.
Absolutely. I mean, I was struck by this once when I had a moment when I was in a snowstorm and I was wearing a dark black coat and a tiny individual snowflake landed on my coat, and I'd, you know, peered in and saw this incredible kind of crystalline structure and this beautiful symmetry in multiple levels. And it gradually melted away after a few seconds. And I was suddenly struck by, you know, just on the street that I'm on, there might be a billion of those individual snowflakes falling right now, of which 999,999,999 are going to turn to dirty slush without anyone appreciating its incredible fractal beauty. And yet God lavishes every hour of every day a snowstorm somewhere where each individual flake is this kind of work of art. And there's this kind of reckless extravagance to God's creation, which, yeah, really moved me, actually.
Yeah, and I think it is such a powerful theme and such a biblical theme, because this is everywhere. And so, first of all, you know, this is a huge problem for atheists. If they're intellectually honest, this is such a massive problem because it is utterly inexplicable. the manifold truth, goodness, and beauty everywhere they look in creation, on which all their science is built, it's just random. It's meaningless. It's a fluke. There is no fundamental. There's no one behind there to worship. You just simply go, wow.
That's nice.
It's done. Isn't that amazing? What a fluke. and yet, you know, what strikes me is that we are called, as Christians, we're called to say, wow. I like this idea. There are only three fundamental prayers. There's thank you, there's please, and there's wow. And this wow of worship that just says, isn't it amazing? And I just want to express the wow back to you, God. And I think it is astonishing, you know, that in Revelation chapter 4, you get this peek into the throne room of God. And there are three great songs going on in the throne room of God, and songs which are going to go on into eternity. And the first song is about existence. It says, praise to you, God, because you existed, you were, you are, and you are to come. It's the fundamental existence of God. But the second great song is in Revelation 4:11, and it says, worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things. And by your will, they existed and were created. So in other words, it seems, you know, this wow, this song of creation is going to go on for eternity. We'll never exhaust the worship that is based on creation. You never go beyond creation. You never get more spiritual and move beyond creation.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, actually, if we're honest, a lot of how modern evangelical churches work is that we actually do move on beyond the doctrine of creation. We think this is a great theme for Sunday school, you know, and I've got books I read to my daughter right now, which are all about, you know, God made the whale and God made the mountain. And isn't that amazing? Wow, God, we love you. But if we're honest, we then do, as we go into our teenage years, put that behind us and move on to the real meat and drink, you know, which is complex theological equations about how atonement works and, you know, the reality of sin and let's, you know, let's start speaking about the end times. That's exciting and confusing, and we do put it behind us. Do you think that's a shame?
I do. I think it's an absolute tragedy. And I'll tell you something else which I think is utterly bizarre, and that is, if you go on to the media, you know, both television, films, and so on, you can still find these most amazing nature documentaries, you know, everything from Attenborough onwards. You'll find, you know, people, you know, documentaries on cosmology and on the beauties of galaxies. You'll find documentaries on the underwater world. You'll have documentaries on life in the womb. You'll find documentaries, you name it, everywhere. And what's more, you know, the track has this kind of worshipful, almost awe-inspired, you know, isn't it? A sense of wonder and awe. Just look at this. Isn't this amazing? We've managed to put a camera inside this nest and just look at what's going on or whatever it is. You know? And so the secular media is actually has a lot of this worship theology and a sense of awe and a sense of wow. Even though the vast majority of the people who are making these documentaries, as far as I know, don't believe in a personal creator at all. They may believe in sort of nature with a capital N. They don't really have any theology. And so when we go to the people who do actually believe in a personal creator, who do actually believe this stuff, you walk into their churches and what do you find? Nothing of that. I'm afraid all you get is a whole diatribe about sin and evil. You think, really? What went wrong?
Do you think this is a, you know, dare I say, a Reformation problem? You know, do you think Protestantism got so focused on, you know, the word and the printing press and the intellectualism and studying the scriptures that we became very kind of, you know, I don't know if it's right or left brain people, but whichever side of the brain does the kind of, you know, the thinking and the writing and the pontificating. And we've lost touch with our kind of artistic, creative, imaginative, spontaneous side. And so we just struggle to see how to integrate that kind of awe-inspiring wowness of nature into our worship.
It's certainly not the Reformation. I think, to be honest, you're completely wrong there. That is a misreading of the Reformation because, why do I say that? Well, Bach was a classic Reformation artist and craftsman who put Solo Deo Gloria on all of his manuscripts. I mean, the Reformation was associated with this, with a great deal of art, which was there for expressing God's music. No, where it all goes wrong is with the Enlightenment. And I think many people have, and I myself included, think that modern evangelicalism is much more influenced by Enlightenment thinking than it realizes. It takes an Enlightenment approach to the scriptures, and it's the Enlightenment which tends to push away the importance of beauty, the importance of and has a much more emphasis on mechanical, cognitive processing. And I'm afraid, I think that we've lost a lot of, we're much more infected by those kind of thinking than we realise.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I have to say, though, as I think about it, I think it's important not to paint a caricature of this, because as I think about it, I think in my kind of adult lifetime, last 10, 15 years of being an evangelical, I think there is the tides are turning on this one. I think there is an increasing recognition of the importance of engaging with art and beauty and creativity. I know, I remember thinking, you know, even when I was a student, I was quite involved in our Christian Union that met on campus, and that was part of this long tradition in Britain, in movement called UCCF, which is all about, you know, Christian students gathering together to evangelize to people. And while we were there, we would gather all the universities in London where I studied, would gather together and do a big, like a mission week, where we put on events, invite non-Christians and have a kind of guest speaker come and share. And these typically, classically, would be kind of apologetics-y, you know, they would be, you know, has science disproved God and all that stuff. But one of the years I was there, and this is, you know, over 10 years ago, they had a speaker come and just do a series of talks looking at films. And they would take a secular film, I think they did Inception, they did Lord of the Rings, and say, you know, what do we appreciate about this film? Why, what does this film speak to us? And then quite skillfully and creatively use that as a foundation to say, you know, well, this draws out these values. And where do these values come from? You know, or why are human beings so interested in self-sacrifice as a motif in literature and art? And where does that come from? And actually use these pieces of creative fiction as a platform for doing evangelism, which I thought was quite interesting and exciting and innovative. So I think there are signs and of progress. I think signs of maybe moving beyond the kind of sterile, arid, kind of hyper-cognitive, mechanistic approach to faith that we're talking about. That might be maybe more of a 20th century phenomenon.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now, of course, I don't want to caricature, but I would just point out that the use of films and so on, that's much more to do with human culture, isn't it? I would still maintain that Christians, evangelical Christians, and probably wider Protestant Christians genuinely, just seem to massively underplay the natural world. It's very rarely a theme in modern worship, isn't it? Although, having said that, I've just remembered that the great song "Indescribable," you know, which is a wonderful. You can you remember the line? I forgot the line. You saw the stars, and you know them by name.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think you know, it is there, but wouldn't it be wonderful to have a whole church service which was filled with images from the James Webb Telescope, the beauty, and which where somebody who knew about cosmology just explained what these pictures show and about the mystery and the wonder and the structure of the universe, and that all this is held in by God's own plans. He saw it and knew it, and it's an expression of God's love.
Do you think the other angle about why our flavour of the church has kind of struggled with this, it is because we are so focused on saying, yes, creation is good, but it's also riven with sin and the fall? And that is, you know, an important biblical theme. I know it's the subject of the next conversation in this series, but I do think that fundamentally the reason why evangelicals struggle with this perhaps is because we're so driven to place grace emphasis on the fact that actually, you know, we don't want to worship God through nature, because that feels kind of neo-pagan, and we don't want to kind of celebrate all that we do and create, because we're aware that a lot of what humans produce is bitter and twisted and broken and wrong.
I'm sure you're right, but I still think it's misguided, because, you know, for modern people, you know, if they do ever go to church and all they hear is a diatribe about sin and evil, you know, that's no great surprises. I knew that anyway. I mean, I only have to switch on the internet. I only have to go on my news feed, and I just see this constant litany of terrible evil. And so, you know, we talked about it before, but what we've got at the moment is a great wave of pessimism, despair, hopelessness, you know, mental health issues and so on. What modern people need to hear is some of what we've been talking about actually, you know what? There's underlying all this, there's amazing truth, there's amazing goodness, there's amazing beauty. That's the message of Christianity. So if I came to church and that's what I heard, I'd go, blimey, that's a different story. I haven't heard that one before.
And I guess a final perspective on this is that, at least for me, it's a different story for you, I guess, but, you know, for my whole life, the message about the creation has been, it's wonderful, but it's broken. We're killing it. It's dying. You know, climate change and carbon emissions is wreaking havoc. And the key kind of narrative around creation is not, oh my gosh, it's so wonderful, what a wonderful God, isn't it beautiful, wow. It is, oh my gosh, it's dying, what a terrible thing we've done, how can we stop this, what, you know, how have we failed? And I think in that context, maybe it becomes harder for Christians who are kind of compelled by the urgency of the climate crisis and guilt, feel, you know, an understandable sense of guilt and shame about how human beings have wrecked it, to then in the same breath say, but gosh, that sunset was stunning, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I hear that, but I think it's a great sadness as well, because it doesn't take into account the extraordinary resilience and dynamism of God's creation. Again, this kind of nostalgic sense of despair. And again, we talked about it before. I don't think it's helpful. I think it's actually, it's damaging. I mean, just a final comment, though. And one of the things that John Stott used to say is he said, of course, you know, as a Christian, you can never know fully everything about the creation. But wouldn't it be a good idea if every single Christian chose just one area, one small area of the creation, and actually tried to become an expert in that little area so that they could appreciate more about the incredible beauty and wonder of what God has made? And he said, and for me, it's ornithology. I just love the way that God has created birds. And I go around the world, as well as taking speaking and leading, I also take the opportunities to go on safaris and bird watching trips. And I think that's a great idea. The idea that each one of us should have something where we really just celebrate the goodness of what God has made as a kind of way of accepting what God has given. You know, if you're a parent, I'm sure you've already had this experience, Tim, you know, and you've labored long and hard on some wonderful gift for your lovely little progeny. And then eventually there comes the great moment and you hand over the gift and all you get is, thanks, Deb, what's next? You know, there's that.
I'm sure it's never happened to you, Deb, because everything you've ever received has been fantastic.
So, but isn't that a picture of God himself who creates this loving attention, all this beauty of the world, only to find that these people aren't that fussed, actually, God. You know, thanks a lot, but there are more important things for me to be concerned about.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. It's true. Well, yeah, there's a good encouragement then. What can we dig in deeper to see, what are we going to become experts in so that I guess for you, it would be the kind of fragility and yet awesome beauty of the newborn human baby, several weeks premature.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, there is something about that. I'm also, I have more than one. I do have an amateurish interest in astronomy and cosmology, and from time to time read astronomy books. So I think, and I do find, I have to say, reading a book about the extraordinary miracle and coincidences that went into the formation of the planet and the formation of life on Earth. At the end of this book, I was filled with more sense of wonder and worship towards the sovereign God who had been supervising these processes for more than 5 billion years on the planet Earth than I did most times at a Christian worship service. Science can move me to a greater sense of worship than many Christian services. And I would love to see more of that sense of worship coming into, for the creation, coming into our natural Christian worship.
Good. Well, I think we probably talked for long enough. That was part one of this new series looking at the doctrine of creation. We're going to pick up, not immediately next week, but over the coming months, we're going to come back and dip into this again. And work through those other kind of three major themes: fall, redemption, and new creation, and how they kind of flesh out this grand narrative of the scriptures that we've been talking about. I hope you found that helpful and interesting. Please do come back to us with your reflections, your thoughts, your feedback. We'd love to hear what you're thinking. You can email us molad at premier.org.uk. You can reach me on Twitter or X or whatever it's called these days, if it still exists. I'm at T.S. Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T. And also, if you go to Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, there's plenty more things to read and to listen to and to watch that might stimulate your thinking and hopefully your worship of the great God we serve. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week with a new episode. Bye-bye.
Of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable. Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.